BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's weekly politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review the news this week is Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, how many thousands of engineering jobs can Bristol afford to lose as BAE Systems prepare to sell off Filton Airdrome for housing? The owners of Filton, BAE, bravely faced the public on Monday this week over their plan to sell the airfield off. They don't need the runway anymore, but by closing the historic aerodrome, they'll leave Airbus, GKN, Rolls-Royce and others high and dry. Peter Cowles was there on Monday and joins us just after six. And University Hospitals Bristol Foundation Trust held their annual general meeting last night. Is it right to have private enterprise leader, that's John Savage, as trust chairman, head also of Business West? Is he introducing so-called patient choice and market forces in Bristol's hospitals? Or is he actually about free public healthcare or privatisation? Daphne Havercroft was there and joins us later. Well, while the propaganda was blasting out nightly on TV screens, they were filming over 4 months during the Libyan civil war, and their documentary Bloody Arab Spring is being shown at the Watershed at 2 o'clock on Sunday. Plus, former soldier Steve McLaughlin, author of the book Squaddy, is here to tell us what being a British soldier is really like. And finally, after last week's fairly serious adult analysis of something called the New World Order, a local primary school child gives us her take. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 10 Celsius and dry this weekend, highs of up to 20 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday, but a little cloudy on Sunday. Next week, highs of, wait for it, right, summer is finally here, 22 Celsius. Cloudier at the beginning of the week, but plenty of sun most of the rest of the week next week. Next weekend, that's the 1st and 2nd of October, highs again round about 20 Celsius and sunny next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining me is Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to Drive Time.
Good afternoon.
Now, first of all, your former job as a Lib Dem MP, before you were doing that, was a corporate tax avoidance advisor, Steve.
Are you? I don't think that was quite the description of my job, but there we are.
Well, you were advising companies on how to pay less tax than they might otherwise do. What did you actually do as part of that job? Can you just take us back a few years?
The last job I had before I was elected Member of Parliament for Bristol West in 2005, I was the tax accountant of the RAC, which is a company which has its headquarters in Bristol. And most of what tax accountants, tax consultants do is making sure that companies pay the correct amount of tax. The vast majority of your time is making sure that you comply with legislation as it currently is, because it's so complicated that you need advice on how to do it. The advisory side on how to optimise your tax bill is a very small part of the role.
So who was actually paying you whilst you were doing that? Was it the company itself? Because, of course, they're going to want to employ someone who's going to be saying you have to pay as little tax as possible. Therefore, they're going to be encouraging you to find ways that they should pay less tax.
Yes, but it's all within the law, isn't it? And I don't think there's anything sinister here. I mean, everyone listening to this programme will, if they've got savings, think it's better to put them in an ISA rather than just leave them in an ordinary bank account, so that you get tax-free savings, and that's within the law. So that I would call that tax planning. You might call it tax avoidance. But the thing is, tax avoidance is not illegal. It's tax evasion that is illegal. Tax evasion is hiding income and gains from the inland revenue so that they don't get taxed at all. Avoiding tax is something you do within the existing law to take advantage of the various incentives that are there. If you have a pension, you get tax relief on that. And if you want to give your tax relief back, then you'd be a very odd human being, I think.
Now, you were working for Grant Thornton and PricewaterhouseCoopers. What kind of companies are these? I think many of us hear these names from time to time. We'll see maybe a talking head pop up on the TV from PricewaterhouseCoopers. But what are these businesses? What kind of companies are they?
Well, PwC, which is where I started when I left university, is probably the world's largest sort of financial consulting firm, doing everything from auditing companies to make sure that their accounts comply with legislation, and indeed, yes, giving tax planning advice to their clients as well. And PwC's clients would be sort of major high street names that are quoted on the stock exchange, right down to small businesses in Bristol. And I worked in the Bristol office, so we had that mixture of work of sort of well-known Bristol firms at the time. And one of my clients, a name that's now disappeared from my high street in Bristol, was Mount Stephens Bakery, for instance.
Now, as an auditor, I mean, you've got a quite important job there, haven't you? You're going into possibly quite a large company, having a look at all of their figures, facts and figures, and you have to actually sort of guarantee, basically, to the tax man and to other public authorities that they're being honest about their business affairs. Now, that's we've seen with companies like Enron and potentially other companies too, that sometimes they have actually been totally dishonest. So how do you guarantee that the figures that we're seeing from the big businesses around us, we've got many here in the city, are actually honest figures?
Well, you've cited Enron, which was an American company. I think it was the, from memory, the Texas office of a firm called Arthur Andersen, where they obviously had some dodgy people working for them who did what they should not have done and said the accounts had a clean bill of health when they quite obviously shouldn't have done. And, of course, that was found out. Not only did the people in Texas of Arthur Andersen lose their jobs, it destroyed the reputation of the firm itself, and the whole firm went down. I remember this very well because it was in the aftermath of the 2001 general election when I fought Bristol West for the first time, and I'd actually given up my job with Grant Thornton at the time to be a full-time candidate on the understanding that I would have no problem at all if I lost finding another job back in my old profession. As it was, the job market was flooded with ex-Arthur Andersen people who'd all lost their jobs because their firm's reputation had been destroyed. That was a one-off, and we've never seen anything like it since.
So are these ex-dodgy accountants now working at Grant Thornton?
Well, I don't know what happened to the people in Texas, but there was no problem with the British firm. But as I say, reputation is everything to a professional firm, whether it's a firm of lawyers, firm of accountants, actuaries, whatever, or architects for that matter. If an architect designed a building that blew up or fell apart, I don't think they get much work in future, and all professions work in the same climate.
But isn't there a financial incentive really on auditors for a company to actually choose an auditor that will find that they have to pay less tax? So they're going to try and find an auditor that will come along to them and say, oh, you only have to pay half as much tax as you used to with the old auditors.
Well, the auditor and the tax consultant are separate roles. I mean, the auditor is looking to make sure that the firm has prepared its accounts in accordance with company law. That is one role that will be performed, for which a fee will be paid. The tax planning is a completely separate role that other people in the firm will do.
Now, you've just also had your Lib Dem conference this week. Can you just give us an impression of what you took to it and what you brought from it?
Well, I hadn't been for 2 years because this time last year I was on a parliamentary exchange with a US congressman. So I was actually in Washington and Alabama rather than Liverpool, where the Lib Dem conference was last year. So I had quite a contrast to make from the last time I went to a conference in 2009 when we were an opposition party to being a party of government. So I now listened to some of my colleagues, such as Vince Cable or Chris Heen, Andrew Stunnell and so on, say that, and I can today tell you that the government is going to do. And nobody has heard that at a Liberal Democrat conference for a very long time, and I certainly haven't. So that was how it felt completely different, but also the sheer number of people who were there, journalists, who I'm sure were desperate to find a split, blood on the carpet and all sorts of rows going on around the edges of the conference, and I think were a little disappointed that we were rather more harmonious and pleased that we were doing good things in government than they expected.
But we had one little test of Lib Dem support here in the city a few weeks ago with the South Mead by-election, and quite clearly the voters, it was actually a Lib Dem seat, and that Lib Dem councillor was removed and replaced with a Labour councillor. It's a pretty clear signal that the electorate in the city don't like the Liberal Democrat Party. So this relationship you're in with the Conservatives seems more like a kind of suicide pact.
Well, We had, of course, a rather wider range of elections in Bristol in May, and of the seats in my parliamentary constituency of Bristol West, the Liberal Democrats topped the poll. If you want to pick on one result in Southmead and extrapolate that across the whole of British politics, you're very welcome to do that, Tony, but I don't think any other sophologists would back you up on that.
So don't you think that, that the Lib Dems... pact with the Conservatives is threatening their control of the city? We're seeing since the election last May, not this May, a slow erosion of seats for the Lib Dems in the city. Now you don't have a majority anymore and you're running a minority administration in Bristol.
Well, forming the coalition was always going to be difficult for the party in the short term. I knew that when I went along with it in the aftermath of the general election. It was a big risk for us to take, but I think it was the right risk to take because the country needed strong and stable governments. We inherited an economy that was in a complete mess, public finances that were in a complete mess, and had to be sorted out, and that's the number one priority of the government. But other things will be delivered in the five-year business agreement. That's how I'd prefer to describe it. You can call it a pact if you like, but it's not a pact. It's certainly not an electoral pact. It's a five-year business agreement within the context of the House of Commons of two parties working together for the good of the country, parking our differences in many ways. A lot of the attention, to be candid, this is a deeply frustrating thing. A lot of the attention goes on what have the Lib Dems not been able to do that they said they would like to do at the last election, rather than looking at the other side as well. There are many things the Tory party wanted to do, like be more generous in inheritance tax. They wanted to scrap the Human Rights Act. Both of those things have been chucked in the bin because the Lib Dems are there.
But the fundamental stuff that for many people is the most important thing they vote
fundamental,
on
Tony.
is education and health. And on both of those fronts, we've got a bit of a disaster looming. First of all, with education, after the promise to get rid of tuition fees, we now have massive tuition fees for all our young people. We're talking about up to sort of £45,000 per person in debt when they finish their course at university, if they go in the first place now. And secondly, with health, this health and social care bill, which looks to many like the first steps towards a wholesale privatisation of the National Health Service.
Well, it looks to many, and I'll dispute the many, and I would dispute the... what do you say about privatisation as well? That's certainly not the intention of the health bill at all. And in fact, new duties are placed on the Secretary of State for Health, duties that I think are very important, like promoting medical research, which is not a duty in the health service at the moment, and also a duty to narrow health inequalities.
Well,
you mentioned Southmead. What is of paramount importance to people in Southmead, however they vote, is that the life expectancy of people who live in places such as Southmead, Lawrence West and Knoll West is probably 10 years shorter than someone who lives in Henleys and Stoke Bishop. And we have those divisions in our own city, we have them elsewhere. Now the government is putting a responsibility right at the top of the health service on the cabinet to narrow those health inequalities through things such as combating smoking, dealing with alcohol abuse, obesity and so on, issues that usually get swept under the carpet because people like to discuss the bureaucracy of the health service, which I don't think is so important to most people.
Well, Glasgow University's department, spinwatch.org, they look at the way that a lot of these sort of messages are spun. Tamsin Cave, who's one of the reporters there, has done a whole report which really shows beyond any shadow of a doubt that the people that are really stand to benefit from the changes that are taking place in the health service is the private healthcare industry, and that they've been lobbying for this slowly but surely behind the scenes for something like 15-20 years, and this is really what they've been asking for all that time, which is the first steps down the road to privatisation, a little bit like we saw, for example, with the Royal Mail. Now there's real serious talk about...
Hang on, they're totally different. What's happened to the Royal Mail? The Royal Mail is a business, that has real difficulty, and the government has passed legislation that means that 3/4 of the shares in Royal Mail can be sold, but 1/4 of the shares will be allocated to the employees, just like John Lewis, for instance, so the employees have a real stake in the business. Royal Mail is a business. The health service is not a business, and it is not being privatised as such. It is free at the point of use. That's what matters to most people. If you fall down and break your leg, you want to know that an ambulance is going to come and pick you up free of charge, take you to an A&E where a doctor and a nurse will attend to you, and there'll be no bill at the end of it, and your leg will be plastered up, and you'll be okay in 6 weeks.
Something a bit artificial about this whole idea of patient choice, like choosing which hospital you go to. Actually, you just want to go to the hospital which is near you, and you want all hospitals to be good.
Well, yes, you do, but you obviously don't meet the people I do in my surgery, not a medical surgery, an MP's advice surgery, but quite a lot of people come to discuss their medical situations with me, and usually they do want some sort of choice. For instance, you know, a woman giving birth will have views over where she wants it to be, at St. Michael's or Southmead, or whether she wants it at home, whether she wants it to be in a bath, all sorts of issues that, as this is a three-way male discussion we're having here, that may not occur to us. But choice in maternity care is important to people. So I don't think I, as a politician, should tell people that here's your healthcare, have it or lump it, take it or leave it. I think in the 21st century, people do expect a bit more personal control over what they get, and are willing to question the assumptions that doctors and other people may have for them.
Okay, well, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is along too. Now, Martin, we've heard this week from various commentators, particularly financial journalists this week, that we seem to be running out of options with money, and there's been quite a run on the stock exchanges again this week. Have we run out of options?
Well, it's looking increasingly like that, isn't it? Basically, what we're being asked to do, or the European countries are being asked to do, is bail out the banks again. It's been presented to us as we've got to rescue Greece, but actually what we're talking about is the banking system. And I think even if the will was there, which is dubious, because, of course, many taxpayers in Germany have been programmed to believe that it's their money and they don't want to pay it out, I don't think the money's there, even if the will is there. So we're actually staring at the possibility of, you know, a major crash and banking collapse.
Okay, and earlier this week, I think it was on Tuesday, in fact, at the IMF, one of their officials, Olivier Blanchard, had this to say.
The global economy has entered a dangerous new phase. The recovery has weakened considerably, and downside risks have increased sharply. Strong policies are needed both to improve the outlook and to reduce the risks. Fear of the unknown is very high. Stock prices have fallen. These will adversely affect spending and growth in the months to come.
That was the IMF's Olivier Blanchard. Martin, what should they be doing? Because we've heard from you quite a few times on here that there's a bit of a political fudge going on, that until the crash actually happens, that they're not going to get their fingers out. So what should they be doing right now?
Well, I think what we've got to recognise is that the private banking system is basically bust, and we've been ignoring this for the last 4 years, and that goes for New Labour people as much as anybody else. I think people will only confront the fact that private banking is bankrupt permanently when it does actually finally go bankrupt. Until it does, people will carry on trying to patch it up. And when they talk about taking strong steps, the politicians must get their act together. What they're talking about is they've got to bully the electorates to come up with the money to bail the banks out again. And actually, I don't think this is viable in any realistic sense. And we'll only start confronting the real problems once we get through the crash.
Okay, so we've heard about Plan A Plus this week, possibly a better way of doing things, slightly changing George Osborne's direction. But Martin, you're in favour of Plan B. What is Plan B?
Well, Plan B is facing up to the fact that the banks are bust. When they were nationalised effectively 4 years ago, we should have started asserting, you know, control over them as a society. But in actual fact, the power relationship is the other way round. So instead of the banks being nationalised, the privatised banks have actually the nationalised banks are now privatising the state. And all of this talk about we've got to live within our means and all the rest of it, this is coming to an end, because it's quite clear that austerity policies, whether pursued in Greece, Ireland, Iceland or Britain, do not in fact decrease deficits, they increase deficits, and this is the killer.
Well, you've introduced Martin as an old Labour economist, and I think we know why now, having heard that. I mean, the issue that we have in the Eurozone, in particular within the European Union at the moment, is undoubtedly very serious. But it's not about the banking system being bust, it's about the national finances of one country in particular, Greece, being in serious trouble and needing assistance either from the IMF, which of course is a global organisation, or the EU closer to home in
but
order to get them back on track. It's not the banking system, it's the government which is overspent and arguably hid the seriousness of its situation in order to join the euro in the first place.
Stephen, you talk about the assistance of the IMF, but isn't that assistance what the IMF have been giving to Greece over the last year or so actually just drawn them deeper and deeper into debt? It's not really assistance at all.
Well, they've been lending them lots of money
that they can't pay.
Well, that then becomes a serious issue. That's, you know, John Redwood, a conservative, my conservative equivalent. I chair the Liberal Democrats Treasury and Business Committee, and John Redwood chairs the backbench Tory equivalent. So we chat often. He repeatedly says, and I disagree with him on this, that you don't give someone who's in debt even more debt in order to make matters worse. You know, you stop feeding the problem. Now, I think actually you don't allow countries or banks, for that matter, to collapse, because, you know, that is not. That is not a situation where they are the only victims. They take other people down with them. That's why it was right in 2008 for the British government to nationalise one bank, not all the banks, as Martin was just trying to suggest, RBS, and effectively take a big stake in Lloyds Banking Group. Because if we hadn't, then the contagion would spread right across the system and more banks would have indeed collapsed.
Martin?
Well, I don't agree that it's not the banks that are, but don't forget, when one bank goes down, if RBS had been allowed to collapse, then it would have had, as you quite rightly say, it would have had an effect through the whole system. So in actual fact, it's a systemic crisis of all banks. I don't believe that the banks are making any profits at all and haven't been for the last 4 years. They're using accounting tricks, but are marking to magic rather than marking to market and all the junk they're holding. Now, in other words, if there were other kinds of industries or other kinds of firms, they would be declared bankrupt and wound up. And I've got a great deal of sympathy with the right-wing economist's view that you shouldn't chuck money at things which are basically bust. Now, of course, the problem is that if they go bust, that can be catastrophic. But we're basically in a situation where we're being held to ransom by the financial markets, who are basically the root of the problem. Greece could easily default. Don't forget, under capitalism, people can just say, we're not going to pay our debts. That's what you do. But if you do that, of course, it brings down the German, French and British banks. That's why they're running around trying to bail Greece out. The Greek people are basically saying, we want out of the euro, we want to default. And that's what people in the streets are saying.
Well, it's not just out of the euro, is it? It's their underlying debts, which would be there whether they're within the single currency or not. So
default. You can default. People did. In the 1930s, every Latin American country, without fail, defaulted. All of them. And that's what's going to happen. Countries are going to default. Banks are going to go down. And we're not going to be talking about managing capitalism anymore. Capitalism, I'm afraid, is dead, although we haven't actually got an alternative.
But surely, Martin...
I think that's more a wish than a prediction or a fact.
Well, let's see what happens in the next between now and Christmas.
But, Martin, if the banks go down, surely it has a massive knock-on effect on the individual sovereign states, because they then can't pay their
staff. Well, the sovereign states are insolvent because the banking system had to be bailed out. There was no underlying problem of public finances until the stock market crashed in 2008. Now, what will happen, in my view, and this is just open to interpretation as we go forward, I think there is no political will to bail the banks out. There's no money to bail the banks out, and therefore they will collapse. And when they collapse, we're not going to be talking about how we're going to balance the books and stay within our means and all the rest of it. Public spending will go up. In the last quarter, the deficit in Britain has gone up, and it's gone up in Ireland, it's gone up in all of these other countries, because austerity does not in fact reduce budget deficits. It never did and it never will.
Stephen, we've heard Martin's solution, right? We've heard that these European finance leaders are running out of options. What would you be saying to them?
I'm
right
not sure.
Now?
We heard Martin's solution.
We heard
a lot of predictions that I don't think you hear from any other independent economists. Look,
we were hearing from Martin, essentially. He thinks that there should be much more government intervention and possibly even nationalisation. What's your idea?
I don't think there's any need for that at the moment. We have nationalised Royal Bank of Scotland. We have an effective control of Lloyds Banking Group. HSBC don't need UK government nationalisation, neither do Barclays, neither do any of the other high street names, Santander and whatever that we could name. We're simply not in that situation. And ultimately, I want Lloyds Banking Group and Royal Bank to return to the private sector as well, where they belong. But I want that to be done in a way that every citizen benefits from the cost that we're undoubtedly all paying for bailing them out in the first place. It cost us £66 billion to save both those banks. And what I came up with an idea back 6 months ago, that every UK citizen should get a share in each of those banks rather than being sold in a conventional privatisation, as most of us would remember from the 1980s. I think that would be a huge mistake. We've all felt the pain in a way from the bailout of the banks. I think we need to get some of the benefit when they do return to financial health. Well, I accept there's a difference in between me and Martin. He thinks they're not going to return to financial health. I think they will.
Right. Well, back to this week's Lib Dem conference, and here is Vince Cable, who's a sort of leader in waiting. In fact, a bit of an orator, really, talking about this very topic.
Living standards have been squeezed by continued high imported inflation. And the painful truth is that Britain is now a poorer country as a result of the financial crash. The public will only accept continuing austerity if it is seen to be fair. Yet there is currently a great sense of grievance that workers and pensioners are paying the penalty for a crisis they did not create.
This is Lib Dem Business Secretary Vince Cable at the conference earlier this week. Stephen Williams, do you agree with him there that actually the pensioners and workers are paying the price for a problem that they didn't create?
Yes, and I run into that anger a lot amongst my own constituents in Bristol West, and that's one of the reasons why I came up with the pamphlets, and you can read about it on my blog if you wish to, and find a link to the full pamphlet, that when Royal Bank and Lloyds Banking Group are returned to the private sector, it should be done in a way that we all benefit. But in between then and now, one of the things that the coalition government is trying to do, that with all the difficult decisions that we're having to make, that we are trying to protect the poor and the elderly from the painful decisions the government is having to make in order to bring down our deficit, which I'll remind you was the largest amongst developed countries when we took office in May 2010, about 12% of our national income was being swallowed up by government borrowing, and that's a colossal figure in historical terms. It's now down to about 9%, and it's going to keep falling over the next 4 years. But even by 2015, when the coalition comes to an end and we have a general election, we will still be borrowing in order to finance our everyday needs.
Martin, what's your thoughts about this? Because this is the fundamentals of the problem. The Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives have been in government now for 18 months or so, and we're still hearing this problem, which is that the poor, the needy, workers, the lower-income workers and pensioners are paying for the mistakes of the bankers and the politicians.
Well, that's an issue of fairness, and I think that, you know, the Liberal Party can suggest quite rightly that they've probably, protected the poorest from the worst effects of what is in effect, in my view, a wrong-headed policy. The deficit, I stress this, the deficit is increasing, and if the economy tanks out, as I expect it will, the deficit will go up because your tax receipts go down and spending on what they call fiscal, what do they call it, automatic stabilisers will go up, things like unemployment benefits, police if people riot and so on and so forth. Now, in all of the countries that have been pursuing austerity, the deficits have actually got worse, and this is what's panicking the markets. The markets on one hand are saying, well, you've got to pursue austerity and you've got to get money, borrow money from taxpayers to bail you out from other countries, but you've got to pursue austerity. But the austerity in Greece has made the situation worse,
okay, so
and it will in this country too.
Well, I would dispute what Martin said, and our deficit is not increasing
over the last 16 months
or so, whatever it is that the coalition has been in office. The deficit has been falling. It's still pretty huge though, and it's still a huge problem to crack. And as I said, by 2015 there still will be a budget deficit, and a lot of people are talking as if the government is aiming to eliminate all government borrowing over the lifetime of this parliament. If only that were possible. Sadly it isn't. We'll still be borrowing money in 2015, but we'll be borrowing less than we are now.
Now, I did have a listen through the Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg's speech, but I couldn't find anything really quite as interesting as the as what Vince Cable was saying. So let's have a listen to Vince again here, talking about economic warfare.
When I joined up, I had very mixed feelings about the coalition, like many of you. And I looked for good precedents. And I thought of Attlee and Bevin working with their Tory opponents, Churchill and Beaverbrook, setting aside their political differences in a common cause. And of course that coalition unleashed the great liberal reformers, Beveridge and Keynes. And you could say, well, you know, that's war. I mean, that was different. And it is different. But we now face a crisis that is the economic equivalent of war. And this is not a time for business as usual or politics as usual.
St- Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West. What does he mean by economic war? He's saying we are living through now a time of economic warfare.
Yes, I mean we could see all around the world, whether it's not just in this country, but what's taking place in Greece, the worry in the United States as well, that we do live in a global economy, and we are having global economic problems. And I'm not sure I would say it's an economic war. It's certainly a huge economic global problem, and that's why it's important now that world leaders get together and try and agree how you solve those problems. In the past, if I can perhaps correct Vince in his history, of course, when there were economic problems, they tended to turn into rivalries, and then military solutions were found to them. And the great benefit that we've had of the last 50 or 60 years, particularly in Europe with the European Union, and I make no apology for being an enthusiast for the European Union, is that we now settle these differences and work together between Germany, France and Britain in particular, in order to find common solutions to our common problems. And the IMF on a global scale does the same.
Well, it doesn't seem to be actually doing that though, Stephen, does it? And this is why maybe people are talking about warfare, is that it looks like there are some real vested interests here and people don't want to budge. The politicians aren't actually able to agree on a way forward.
Well, a lot of agreement has been put in place, and there is a general consensus that it is not sensible for governments to continually spend more than they're able to take from their economies in taxation in particular. Greece has behaved, I would say, recklessly over a long period of time in hiding the true scale of its disastrous public finances.
Say a bit like Enron did in their day.
You could say that. You could say that.
Martin, what do you think about Vince's reference to economic warfare? And he was comparing things with the Second World War.
Well, I actually agree with him. And of course, if the banks collapse, as I suspect they will, we are going to have real warfare. Perhaps not immediately on the streets of Britain, but in places in the Third World, it will begin very quickly. I mean, in Mexico, for example, something like 50,000 people have died in drug-related violence in the last 3 years.
But what has that got to do with the financial
crisis?
Because
once you've got no employment and no future, then people start doing all sorts of irrational things. Now, the point is that you can't, in fact, cut deficits by attempting to cut public expenditure. Maybe public expenditure is too high. Maybe it is. That's another issue. But attempts to cut public expenditure at this point will not solve the problem. They will make it worse. And at that point, everything will go down the drain.
Now, Stephen,
well,
I don't
not to mention drugs in Mexico. So I do have to say one thing that was passed at the Lib Dem conference was a motion saying we do need a proper, sensible, evidence-based discussion about drugs policy in this country. One of the things that infuriates me about debate in Britain is that on immigration, on race, some other moral issues, and drugs in particular, it's almost impossible to have a rational discussion amongst politicians or between politicians and journalists without being accused of selling drugs to children or allowing heroin addicts to take over the country or whatever.
Ed Miliband was questioned about this, and he immediately slapped down the debate, which very much disappointed me. Mm. But I'm very pleased to see that the Liberals are prepared to take it up.
Well, let's have a listen to the end of Vince Cable, the leader in waiting, shall I say, speech of the Lib Dem at the Lib Dem conference. And here is when he bravely broaches the subject of lying politicians.
When my staff saw my draft of this speech, they said, well, you know, we can see the grey skies. Where are the sunny uplands? And I have to say, I'm sorry. I can only tell it as I see it. I think people aren't projecting 10 years ahead when they're worrying about how to survive the next 10 days to their payday. But I do sense a deeper truth, that the public is tired of being lied to by politicians and promised what cannot be delivered. Because the truth is that there are difficult times ahead, that Britain's post-war pattern of ever-rising living standards has been broken by the financial collapse. But I believe we can turn the economy round, and we will. In the coalition agreement, we promised to put fairness at the heart of all we do. And as we rebuild our broken economy from the rubble, Liberal Democrats know that you can't do one without the other. So we must now do both, fairness and recovery. Thank you.
That was Vince Cable, the end of his speech at this year's Lib Dem conference earlier this week. Now, Stephen Williams, you're a Lib Dem MP for Bristol West. What are your thoughts then about what Vince is saying there? Because it's all very well talking about fairness, but there's no sign of any recovery yet, is there?
Yeah, but I was sat in the hall listening to him, and I should call him Uncle Vince or not, but I think Uncle Vince tells it how it is, and I think that's his great attribute. While he is good at sound bites occasionally, I don't think he can be spun by anyone else, and he always tells things how he sees them, and even if they are painful and uncomfortable truths for his opponents or indeed his colleagues, and I think that's his great strength, and I'm really glad that he's there as one of the key ministers in the coalition.
But where
government.
Is this recovery coming from?
Well, I think where the recovery will come from is obviously in growth in certain areas of the economy, and what Vince as the business secretary is trying to do to make sure that growth comes about from, for instance, a green economy. And in fact, I proposed the motion at the Lib Dem conference in Birmingham this week of a green stimulus to economic recovery, for instance, calling for the establishment of the Green Investment Bank that the government is doing, and I do hope that's going to end up being located in Bristol so that we can fund the renewable energy systems that we need. The Green Deal is coming through next year, where every household in Bristol will be able to have £10,000 in order to retrofit their houses. And if you look at the houses in Bristol, particularly in my constituency, whether they're Georgian houses in Clifton or late Victorian houses in Easton, they're pretty awful on an energy efficiency front. So we need to do a lot of work to get their windows up to scratch, loft insulation, and maybe wall insulation as well, to reduce our energy bills. But a lot of new jobs will come from this area. We've had a lot of hot air from the last government about dealing with climate change. They didn't do very much about it. This government has actually got some really radical things in place to deal with climate change, but also to have a new type of economy in the future. And I think a lot of our growth will come from that sector.
Well, one of the things that's going to be definitely persuading people to get their solar panels stuck on their roofs is the present price of energy and the massive increases of gas and electricity prices. Before we hear a little discussion from Five Live earlier this week, Martin, can you just give us an idea of why it is that, for some reason, there seems to be such relaxed regulation of these private industries, particularly of gas and electricity industries, where the prices are going up when the wholesale prices are increases, but when the wholesale prices come down, the retail prices that we have to pay don't come down.
That's because they're being run for private profit, and in actual fact they were better off being run in the public sector. You'd expect me as an old Labour person to say that. And a lot of the problems we've got in this country came from the privatisation ethos of the 1980s, which New Labour bought into as much as anybody else. And of course, actually, it's all wrong. They don't run it like that in places like Norway, and they're right and we're wrong.
So, Stephen, what are your thoughts before we hear this little clip about the utilities, the gas companies, the electricity companies? They're doing this thing now nowadays, which they quietly behind the scenes call confusion marketing, where you can't actually make a decision about which of these suppliers to go for, because you can't directly compare one tariff with another tariff. Now, this seems deliberately designed to confuse us. So, you know, that's a slightly biased, spun question. But what are your thoughts about these privatised utilities? Because they don't seem to be delivering the goods.
No, I think I might agree with what you've just said there. Of course, we actually have remarkably few energy providers in this country. I think there's six, really, overall, six big players anyway. And another thing that the government is doing, Chris Hume, the Liberal Democrat Energy Secretary, is having an energy market reform, which is going to be taking place over the next few years. He's just started consulting on that, and one of the things we need to see is more competition, perhaps, other people providing the energy. Of course, if we're going to completely revolutionise how we source our energy in the first place, hopefully from clean and renewable sources, then there's an opportunity to do just that.
Now, so let's have a listen to the Victoria Derbyshire and Dominic Laurie from BBC Radio 5 speaking earlier this week.
There is some differential between the six companies, but they do seem to be, as often happens, they're moving in a pack, as it were. Mm. You know, this series of price rises.
Cartel, I might call it. You call it a pack, I call it a cartel.
So what do you call it, Stephen, a pack or a cartel?
I think I ought to be careful whether to call it a cartel. But they certainly, there isn't much differentiation in between them. And I think certainly on price, it's quite hard, as you were saying, for people to be able to genuinely compare whether you're getting the best deal and how easy it is to switch. I mean, personally, if I'm allowed to advertise on this program, I don't know. I use a company called Good Energy to source my electricity at home. Good Energy is a company based in Chippenham, so it's fairly local, and they have a green energy tariff, and all the energy that they buy off the grid is from renewable sources. So I've taken that decision, but of course it is more expensive than the normal providers such as EDF that we've all heard of.
Now, Martin, how are we going to fix this? Because these companies are making massive profits. They're also hiking up the price of energy just as we're coming into winter.
Well, I wouldn't call it a cartel or a pack. I'd call it an oligopoly. That's what they call it in the textbooks. And oligopolies always behave like this. Six firms in a market is not a competition. And this is a common misconception that people have. And then they think, oh, if we get 7 or even 12 firms, then we'll have a competition. In actual fact, a competition in a textbook, an economics textbook, requires hundreds of firms. And we've got nowhere near that. Because it's the technology involved in generating electricity. It's big scale stuff. You've got to have large investments to do it. And that's why these industries were nationalised in the first place. And the case for nationalising industries, I want to see that made by the Labour front bench. After the crash, of course. We'll have to wait.
That, I think.
Okay,
wait till the crash happens.
Okay, Stephen, I'm going to leave the final word on to you on this one. How do we get reasonable price electricity and gas where we're not paying fat cat bosses at these private companies and we're not paying for the benefits to shareholders? We're just paying for the gas.
I think, if you just think rationally, and let's forget who's providing the energy at the moment, it's pretty hard to see any other direction than up where energy prices are going to go in the long term, because at the moment our energy is sourced from finite resources, whether it's coal or oil or gas, and the price for those is only going in one direction as more and more parts of the planet industrialise. You know, China... it's one of these statistics you hear and you never know whether it's true, apparently opens a power station practically every month in order to meet its insatiable demand for energy. So I think the pressure is going to be upward on prices. The only way we are going to combat that, and we need to do this not just to protect the poor from rising energy prices, but also to save the long-term viability of our planet, is to have greener sources of energy, which can be much more local, of course. And there is an opportunity for communities, and this is something that really would excite me, whether to have it on their church hall or the school roof, whatever it is, to generate small amounts of electricity and sell it back into the grid. And that sort of more localised distribution of power may be the way forward.
Now, talking of local power, we have on the horizon two possible new nuclear power stations, one at Oldbury and one at Hinkley. What are your thoughts about the rights and wrongs of that? Because really the Liberal Democrats are kind of up against it. Chris Hughne is up against it, with the Conservatives very much for it, and certainly your commitment before the general election was very much anti-nuclear.
The party's stance, yeah, has been much more anti-nuclear than both the other parties. I mean, both the Labour Party and the Conservative Party were committed to a new generation of nuclear power stations, but we've always been much more circumspect about it. My own personal opinion is that it is illogical to be against nuclear power on principle. You can have views about how you deal with the waste or something, but to be just firmly against it, I think, is illogical. And I think nuclear has to remain part of our energy mix for at least the next couple of decades, because we can't get from where we are now, a high carbon dependent energy mix, to a low carbon economy in one fell swoop. That simply can't be done. So we're going to need nuclear as part of that mix.
Well, we need nuclear, but do we need to build new nuclear power stations now?
Well,
or could we just let the existing ones, like the Germans are doing? They're closing all theirs down, aren't they?
Well, the existing ones that we have in Britain that supply just under a fifth of our energy needs, perhaps closer to 15%, in fact, many of them are nearing the end of their useful life because they were built in the 60s, and they are the ones that will have to be replaced. And of course, we know locally that some of the nuclear power stations we have around the Severn Estuary have closed in the last decade.
But can I just pin you down on this? Hinkley and Oldbury, are you in favour or against the new ones?
Well, it's not a like for like. I well remember people protesting against, I think it was Hinkley C, wasn't it, being built in the 1980s, or planning for it in the 1980s, and I think they had a fair point at the time. A modern generation of nuclear power stations has a much smaller sort of footprint in the local area and has a better way of dealing with its waste.
Well, certainly the look of the new Oldbury power station is absolutely massive, with all these cooling towers, acres and acres, a gigantic site.
Well, generating power on a mass scale, you know, is you can't avoid having power stations, can you? So while I do want to see more decentralised energy, I do want to see more renewables closer to the demand for the power. I don't think we're going to be able to get away from a situation where we have large power stations. You know, every time I take the train to and from London, we pass Didcot and see the enormous site that covers and the huge heaps of coal that are needed to power that power station.
But to be fair, Didcot isn't quite as picturesque as the Severn Valley.
I'll leave that statement hanging in the air.
I'm sure
it was prettier before that was put there.
Even the Didcot residents, I think, would agree with that one. Anyway, let's move on and talk about this week's United Nations General Assembly has been getting together, and Prime Minister David Cameron gave a speech yesterday.
Reform is the basis of long-term stability. Authoritarianism threatens it. While there is never a justification for resorting to terror, if people's hunger for a job and a voice are denied, there is a real risk that the frustration and the alienation they feel can cause them to be drawn to more violent and extremist responses. That is not just a problem for one region, it is a problem for all of us too. Here in this great city of New York, where 10 years ago people of 90 different nationalities were killed in the most horrific terrorist attack in history, we must recognize that political and economic reform in the Middle East is not just good in its own right, but it is also a key part of how in the end we will defeat Al-Qaeda. Of course, we must meet terrorist activity with a strong and resolute security response. Al-Qaeda and its offshoots must know they will have no safe hiding place to plot or recruit young men to train as terrorists. But in the long term, we must defeat not only the terrorists, but the extremist ideology that feeds them. Al-Qaeda's poisonous ideology has thrived on repression. Democracy is what it fears most.
That was David Cameron speaking yesterday in New York at the General Assembly of the United Nations 2011. Martin, I'm going to ask you on this one first. He's talking there about defeating an ideology of Islamic extremism. Is he going to ever manage to do that?
Well, I think it's rather interesting that the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya, who are now playing a very big part in the National Transition Government, which David Cameron has helped to put in, are Al-Qaeda Libya. So there we go. And they've been working with the Western Intelligence Services for many years to get rid of Gaddafi. And we're dealing with them. They're saying that they want Sharia law, but they're okay, that we support them and all the rest of it. It's very contradictory. Many people, when he talks about Al-Qaeda's affiliates, many people think Al-Qaeda is affiliated with the Western Intelligence Services. That's well believed in the rest of the world. Not well understood in the West, but everybody else understands it.
And what about the bid for Palestine? Because this is one of the big things that's happening right at the moment, is that there was an attempt by the Palestinians to get their own state, and this apparently has been blocked by procedural methods. But what do you think in principle? Should the Palestinians be able to force a vote at the UN?
Yes, they should, and they should get it. Incidentally, can I just give a plug to a meeting next Tuesday at the Hamilton House, where
that's on Stokes Croft.
It's at 7:30, and it's a young Israeli woman who refused to serve in the Israeli armed forces. Her name's Lihar Rothschild, and she's 27, refused to serve in the Israeli armed forces, and is very much in favour of a Palestinian state, as many progressive Israelis are.
So, Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, what's your thoughts about what you heard from David Cameron there? He's, you know, fast talking on destroying the ideology of Islamic extremism, and also on the business of Palestine.
Well, I think every rational person would agree with the Prime Minister's aim of trying to root out terrorism from wherever it's found.
But what about this Islamic business Martin was
fundamentalism
talking about?
Sometimes contribute to that.
He's saying now that in Libya, some of these Muslim fundamentalists are now some part of the government.
Some of them, I mean, clearly. This is one of the difficulties, isn't it, with the Arab Awakening, I think we're meant to call it now, not the Arab Spring, is that the forces that wish to see the overthrow of these military sort of secular dictators, whether they were Mubarak in Egypt or Assad, who is still there in Syria, have a mixture of motives. Some of them are secular Democrats that we would wish to associate with. Some of them are Islamic fundamentalists who those dictators were suppressing. So there were a mixture. There's a coalition of people, if you like, who wanted those dictators gone. And some of them are decent people who I hope we can do business with, and some of them probably not so decent. But on Palestine, I would hope that the United Nations would give recognition to Palestine itself. And I'm deeply disappointed that Barack Obama has decided to use the US veto to block that. I've been to Palestine twice in the last year and a half or so. I've been to Gaza and seen the situation there myself. I was in West Bank and East Jerusalem in May and June this year, and this is an interest that I pursue as much as I can in Parliament and engaging with people from all perspectives. And we all know, and I think most rational Israelis know this as well, that we must have a genuine sort of statehood for the Palestinian people very soon, because that Israel's security simply cannot be guaranteed in the long run unless this problem is solved.
And Martin, what are your thoughts on that? And also this whole business of what we were talking about just now, I don't really feel we've resolved it. Why is David Cameron now deciding that he wants to get rid of these ideologies? Because, I mean, it sounds a bit peculiar trying to get rid of ideologies, because these ideas have been around in the Middle East for centuries. Well, Why are they no longer okay?
I think we've got to draw a distinction between people who carry out terrorist acts and people who have political goals, as we did in Ireland, for example, in the long run. And I think demonising Islamist political movements doesn't solve any problems, whether it's Hamas in Palestine or the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya, for that matter. But I'd also, I mean, obviously I want recognition for the Palestinians. I think people have also got to recognise that for many, many years, the Western intelligence services have been working with Islamic extremist groups. The Haqqani network, which has carried out this assassination in Afghanistan last week, they were our allies in the 1980s. They got all of their training from us. They're trained by our own people. Now, people have got to recognise this. We are the root of the problem. We have been for a long time. And that doesn't mean that things haven't, that there aren't problems out there that have got to be resolved politically. They do have to be resolved politically.
And now, let's have a listen to the Iranian president, a little clip from his speech, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. And when he started to speak, many of the delegates, most of the European delegates at the United Nations and the US delegates, walked out. So there were probably only about half of the national delegates still left in the hall, including, interestingly, the Iraqis, I noticed, because I couldn't find a list of exactly who stayed and who didn't, but they were still in there listening to him. So let's also have a listen to the Iranian president speaking at the UN yesterday now.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, all praise be to Allah, the Lord of the universe, and peace and blessing be upon our Master and Prophet Muhammad and his pure household, his noble companions, and on all divine messengers. O God, hasten the arrival of Imam al-Mahdi and grant him good health and victory, and make us his followers and all those who attest to his rightfulness. Who provoked and encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade and impose an 8-year war on Iran, and who assisted and equipped him to deploy chemical weapons against our cities and our people? Who used the mysterious September 11th incident as a pretext to attack Afghanistan and Iraq, killing, injuring, and displacing millions in two countries, with the ultimate goal of bringing into its domination the Middle East and its oil resources. Who undermined the Bretton Woods system and printed trillions of dollars without the backing of gold reserves or equivalent currency, a move that triggered inflation worldwide and was intended to prey on the economic gains of other nations? What country's military spending exceeds annually $1,000 billion, more than the military budgets of all countries of the world combined? Which governments are the most indebted ones in the world?
That was the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaking yesterday at the United Nations. Now, Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP, what do you make of his talking there about really blaming the Western countries, Europe and the United States? He did talk about colonialism, which we didn't hear about there, but also modern day, saying basically we're a bunch of warmongers, and also we made a mess of the financial system.
Well, that was a rare treat, I have to say, Tony, listening to President Ahmadinejad of Tehran, one of the most vile people on the planet, I think. So I'm not sure we can pay much attention to his words of wisdom.
But is he right about the principle that we have caused this global financial...
I don't think he's right about very much at all. This is a man who strings people up from a crane in the centre of Tehran if they transgress Iranian laws. He's a mass murderer. the Iranian regime is one of the most appalling on the planet.
So why would I take it you would have walked out if he'd have started speaking at the UN?
No, I wouldn't. I actually think it is much better to listen and engage with people than to boycott them or refuse to discuss issues with them. But somebody like the president of Iran is probably one of the more difficult people to have a rational discussion with. I think he's in a class of his own on the world stage.
But I think he made quite a good point there. He's saying, look, what the West has done to the world financial system, they've made a mess of it.
I think we'll have to disagree on this one, Tony.
Okay, Martin, what do you think about his speech? And he mentioned, just as David Cameron did, 9/11 as well. There.
Well, I mean, Robert Burns once said, "Oh, what gift the beastie gives to see ourselves as others see us." Now, we may not like it coming from the mouth of Ahmadinejad, and of course there are many problems in Iran, although there have been free elections, unlike in Saudi Arabia or Bahrain, our allies, of course. When, I'm waiting for the bloody revolution in Saudi Arabia. I want to see the RAF bombing Riyadh to get the rebels in power. That'll be good. That'll be a day, won't it? And you can understand why people think we're hypocrites and liars. The eight-year war against Iran, which actually brought the extremist regime to power, you know, the attack by Iraq on Iran in 1980, actually got rid of the liberals in the regime and brought in the fundamentalists.
I don't think Ayatollah Khomeini was ever a liberal.
Well, no, but there was actually Bani Sadr was, and he was in alliance with Ayatollah Khomeini until Iraq attacked Iran at the West surging, killing millions of Iranians. Now, in actual fact, in the world at large, Britain, the United States and the West are not regarded as the good guys, whether we like it or not. Maybe it's not fair, but the fact is that most poor people in most of the world think we're the problem, and in many ways I think they're right.
Okay, well, thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. After the news, how many thousands of engineering jobs can Bristol afford to lose as BAE Systems prepare to sell off Filton Aerodrome?
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the